With all the twists and turns in the global economy these days, sub-Saharan Africa is actually holding its own.
The direct effect on much of the region has not actually been that significant.
The latest regional economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa estimates growth will hold at 4.1% this year and pick up slightly in 2026. But a fast-growing population is adding pressure for the region to produce more jobs, with past outlooks suggesting it'll take 15 million per year just to keep up with the number of young people entering the labor force.
If this can come off, this is an amazing demographic dividend. The flip side of 15 million new jobs needed is what happens if those 15 million jobs don't appear.
The IMF's latest regional economic outlook has some ideas about how to avoid that problem.
Jobs come from firms, and firms in sub-Saharan Africa right now are really struggling to grow. There's a lot of things holding back firm expansion and firm growth. So unlocking the ability for firms to grow and employ more people is really, really important on the continent.
I'm Athene Laws. I'm an economist in the Regional Studies Division of the African Department here at the IMF.
Athene Laws is part of a team of economists that pull together the Regional Economic Outlook for Sub-Saharan Africa twice a year, the latest one titled Holding Steady.
So Africa was the first place that came to mind when we started hearing about the dismantling of U.S. aid, which has since led to many other traditional donors to pull back on development assistance. So what has this near total collapse of development funding meant for sub-Saharan Africa?
Sure. So a few things there. It's not a near total collapse. Our estimates are currently a 16 to 28% cut in official development assistance for the region, which is still very significant.
Yeah, I would have thought that it was much higher than that.
Yeah. And it does come on top of a couple of decades now of declining official development assistance as a function of GDP. So to some extent, continuing a pre-existing trend, but also a really quite dramatic shift. And it's new in a number of ways. Just the scale of the cuts is new, the widespread nature, both the recipient countries are all being hit. And as you said, it's all traditional donors, or almost all traditional donors are cutting their budgets in different ways, some quite suddenly, some unexpectedly, some are a bit more phased, but the general trajectory is downwards. So this is obviously of major concern to the region. One thing to note is that not all countries are directly affected. So many sub-Saharan African countries don't receive that much ODA. So they're not directly buffeted too much. However, there's a number of small, fragile, low-income countries, often conflict-affected or neighbours of conflict-affected states suffering some spillovers. And for a number of these, the hit can be dramatic. So countries like the Central African Republic or South Sudan, the potential cuts being faced are more than 10% of government revenue. And these will hit primarily health, education, basic humanitarian functions like food aid. So the humanitarian costs could be immense.
Yeah. So the report does talk about how resilient many of these countries have been, thankfully. But resilience isn't necessarily something that these countries haven't known for many years. There always seems to be some kind of difficult circumstance to overcome, leaving them little choice but to be resilient. So, I mean, how can they actually one day turn this resilience into actual growth rather than sort of moving from one shock or surviving one shock to the next?
Yeah, the region has been hit by just a series of very, very difficult shocks over a long time, as you say. And so the resilience is quite remarkable and should really be commendable. A lot of it comes from quite difficult policy reforms and policy adjustments that many governments have done. So that's great. And obviously, resilience is preferable to not having resilience when
that's
you face
right.
these shocks. So that's definitely a positive. And I will say that resilience is a necessary condition for sustainable development, right? You can't have sustainable development if you don't have resilience. Otherwise, when the next shock hits, you'll just lose all the gains that you previously made. So it's absolutely necessary and fundamental. But as you said, it's not sufficient for sustainable development. So as you correctly identify, the challenge now is to safeguard that resilience. And that's a big focus of the report, because we do see building vulnerabilities, both in terms of fiscal fragilities, countries not having enough fiscal space to deal with the next shock, Some countries have declining reserves or low reserves. So a third of countries have less than 3 months of import cover, which is sort of our gold standard sufficiency. A number of countries, so one in five countries, still have double-digit inflation. So we do need to rebuild and safeguard that resilience. And then on top of that, as you said, we need to move to sustainable development. And that's going to require a range of policies to sort of kickstart the next growth and sustainable development phase. Everything from investing in basic human development issues, so core education, core healthcare, core social spending, investing in the skills of today and tomorrow is really, really important to kickstart sustainable growth. Infrastructure, both of the physical type and also the digital type, is really important. But also, a lot of these things, they do cost quite an amount of money, and public finances are very tight on the continent right now in many places. And so that's where we'll need to build some more domestic revenue mobilization, which basically means raising more taxes locally. And I think we'll probably talk a bit more about that later.
But yeah, well, I mean, while we're there, these outlooks generally are more than just forecasts. Mm-hmm. They like to provide some constructive policy advice. And this idea of collecting more taxes and collecting them more effectively, or domestic revenue mobilization in IMF speak. But how feasible is that when, as you said, a lot of these economies are struggling? They're basically in survival mode.
Yeah, so I know we talk a lot about domestic revenue mobilization, a very technical term, basically means collecting more taxes. I think it's helpful first to take a step back and think about why we keep talking about that. Mm-hmm. And the reason really is that the development needs and the development spending needs of the region are absolutely immense. And yet external financing is very limited. Debt levels are high and debt service capacity is quite strained. And so the money for these services has to come from somewhere, and that's when the collecting more taxes locally comes in. We also see that the tax revenue to GDP ratio in the region is very low compared to much of the rest of the world. So the median country collects about 13% of GDP in tax revenue each year. And recent IMF research has shown that once you get past what we call a tax tipping point, so around about 15% of GDP, then a whole bunch of really good things start to happen. So growth takes off sustainably and durably. State capacity and government services improve. Financial sector develops more. So for all these reasons, to fund development and to increase state capacity, given the very low tax base already, it is really important to make progress on collecting more taxes domestically. It is very hard, as you said. Mm-hmm. We've been bumbling around that approximate level for a while now for the region. It's quite hard to make sustained progress, but it's not impossible. Luckily, there's quite a few good examples from around the region, and we can get quite a lot of lessons learned from that. Overarching is that trust and sequencing is just as important as technical fixes when it comes to raising more revenue.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, people don't want to pay taxes if they don't think that the money will be spent on good services and for the public good. So building trust around that and accountability is really important. In terms of the technical side of things, the countries that have shown what can work, digitalization can help a lot with collecting taxes. That's on the what we would call tax administration side.
Yeah.
Supporting taxpayer take-up, making it very easy to pay taxes. You don't want paying your taxes to be a super onerous affair, ideally. Mm. Integrating systems is really important. When you think about what to tax and how to tax it, there's quite a lot of scope in the region to rationalize things that we call tax expenditures, which is essentially things like tax exemptions, preferential rates, that sort of thing. And so broadening the tax base, closing up some of the loopholes, those are perhaps a slightly easier ways or easier in terms of political economy ways to collect more taxes. Mm. Another thing to think about is when you're designing the policies to consider things like piloting and phasing, so trialing out things on a small scale before you build it.
Yeah.
And maybe don't tackle everything hard all at once, but phasing is very important to the success of a policy. And at the end of the day, it does need to have support from the public, support from the political side of things to make this work. It's difficult, but it's very important, and it's not impossible.
Mm. And you just mentioned digitalization when
yes.
it comes to, you know, helping more effective tax collection and increase revenues and boost growth. And I'm not sure to what degree technology actually makes it into this particular regional outlook, but in advanced economies, at least, we hear a lot about the AI promise in terms of providing the growth that's needed to deal with the high levels of debt in a lot of economies. What does the AI promise look like for sub-Saharan Africa?
I think the big question about AI for sub-Saharan Africa is whether we end up in a scenario where it helps the region leapfrog in development, so catch up very rapidly to other countries, or a different scenario where the region gets left behind. And so I think that's the main question for the region. The AI promise, it certainly has a lot of promise for the region across a number of levels. So we talked a bit about tax administration. AI has quite a lot of potential and already some good use cases for things like customs collection. You can better identify the risky shipments and collect customs better, more efficiently. It certainly has growth and productivity promises for the region. Just think of agriculture as one potential example. There's many. Improving agricultural productivity is one of the best ways that you can lower poverty in the region. And agricultural productivity in sub-Saharan Africa is very low relative to the rest of the world. And yet things like AI can really help with all sorts of aspects of agriculture. It can help with crop forecasting, designing seeds or allocating the right seeds, improving agricultural markets and agricultural demand, supply matching. So there's a lot of potential there. Also, as we said, the development needs on the continent are vast. There's a large and growing population that all need to be educated. Health services are stretched thin. So AI, there's increasing use cases of AI potential for helping augment the existing health and education workforces. It can perhaps improve service delivery, including in hard-to-access communities. So there's a whole bunch of ways that it could help. In terms of labour markets is another one, whether it will augment labour markets and skills across the continent.
Yeah.
But really the question is it going to help Africa relative to the rest of the world? And so IMF research suggests that advanced economies are going to be the ones that are first exposed both to the benefits and the downsides of AI. And so then the real risk is Africa going to fall behind? And what policymakers should be doing is investing in skills, investing in digital infrastructure as much as possible to get us into that leapfrog scenario.
Then that brings us to this issue that many of the regional outlooks have been talking about for, you know, we've done podcasts on regional economic outlooks for sub-Saharan Africa for many years now. And the one thing that comes up all the time is the potential for a demographic dividend. And, you know, with AI, I mean, AI introduces a kind of an interesting dynamic there. Do we still expect the region to benefit from its young and expanding labor force, given the advent of AI and, you know, combined with all the turmoil, economic turmoil out there?
So the demographics are pretty strong in Africa. It's a very young, very dynamic, very growing population. Our past work estimates that the region needs 15 million new jobs per year by 2030, just to keep up with demographics. If this can come off, this is an amazing demographic dividend, right? This is we've seen this in East Asia before. A young, growing, productive, dynamic population becomes a huge center of consumption and investment for the whole world, not just for the region itself. So it's certainly got a huge potential to be a demographic dividend.
Are we worrying about the skill set, given the AI element there?
So in terms of what it needs to be done to harness it is a different story, right? The flip side of 15 million new jobs needed is what happens if those 15 million jobs don't appear. And that's quite concerning from a humanitarian point of view, a poverty point of view, unemployment, instability. So there's a number of things that need to happen to help get to that demographic dividend side, one of which the continent is a really, really high rate of informality. So that's a reality that's unlikely to change immediately anytime soon. So harnessing informality from a trap, which it quite often is right now, keeping people in low-paid and secure jobs and helping them move up the job ladder into better-paying jobs, ideally formal, but also higher-quality informal is one way to help with the jobs. Another one is that jobs come from firms. And firms in sub-Saharan Africa right now are really struggling to grow. There's a lot of things holding back firm expansion and firm growth. Everything from electricity to infrastructure to perceptions of corruption. So unlocking the ability for firms to grow and employ more people is really, really important on the continent. And then the other one, which links more in with your technology question, is sort of the big picture structural question about how do countries move from low productivity sectors to higher productivity sectors. So that was often called structural transformation. In the past, in East Asia, for example, it used to be moving from agriculture into manufacturing. Manufacturing's changed already in the last number of decades with technology. It's not so labor-intensive anymore. It tends to be higher skilled. So there's an open debate about whether countries can move instead to higher quality services to increase up the sort of the quality chain of industries. So technology comes into that. How labor market's going to look, I think across the world, that's an open question, and what skills are going to be needed is part of it. But I think that the bread and butter basics, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that can still be done in sub-Saharan Africa, just getting the business environment right, getting the basic health and education right, looking at informality settings and labor markets. So those are first priority.
And finally, obviously, the international trade is going through a rough patch at the moment. What does that mean for these sub-Saharan, these countries in sub-Saharan Africa that are trying to build, you know, to the best of their abilities, their economies for the future?
Yes. So as you identified, there's been quite a marked shift in trade policy around the world. Global economic policy uncertainty is at extreme heights at the moment. What we do notice in sub-Saharan Africa is that the direct effect on much of the region has not actually been that significant. The direct effect has been reasonably modest. And that's for a number of reasons. One of which is that many countries in the region don't trade that much with the USA, which has been the primary trade policy changes have been there. Or much of what they do trade with the USA is exempt from tariffs, so things like oil and other commodity exports. So for much of the region, the direct effect is limited, but most of the impact will be indirect. So effects of trade policy changes or uncertainty on the global economy can affect demand for commodities that might suppress prices, which is particularly important for all the commodity exporters in the region. It might affect trade and investment in the region from other areas. So the indirect effects are more significant for a lot of the region. Having said that, though, there's a number of countries that have been quite exposed to this. For example, Lesotho, a small low-income country, more than 10% of its GDP is exports to the USA, and that's in textiles. And that sector was set up in response to previously preferential access. So Lesotho's been hit very hard by this, so is the likes of Madagascar. What can the region do in the face of all these changes? One thing that we've been advocating for a long time has been to fully implement the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. So really double down on trade integration for the region. We talked about the demographics of Africa. Africa is a fast-growing region. This is huge potential for itself to really leverage that. Previous IMF work suggested that if you were to pair full implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement with other intra-regional trade integration means, that could be a boost of more than 10% of per capita GDP. So that's massive,
that's
right? And that will swamp any other changes going on at the moment. So there's a lot to be done within Africa that can really help with this.
Athene Laws, economist in the African department here at the IMF and one of the authors of the Regional Outlook for Sub-Saharan Africa. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So again, that was IMF economist Athene Laws talking about the latest regional economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa, which you can download at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.